Hey guys, welcome back to the podcast. I'm Jeanette.
And I am Emily.
Oh man, I'm gonna tell it straightforward. I'm not excited for this episode.
Yeah, I get that. That's fair.
I just don't want to be sad.
You'll be sad for a little bit, but the story has an ending.
It's true. We had a nice little break in between these episodes, though, so that's good.
We talked about just family ghosts, and we had a guest, so we're okay.
Exactly. It was a lot more lighthearted. So now it's time for this, and I don't want it.
It is. I'm trying to think if we have anything that we need to cover before we get into it, because this is a long episode. Like, I have more notes than I did for part one.
I'm sure you'll get through them pretty quickly.
I'm sure I will. I talk really fast. I always have so many notes, and then I'm through them in like 30 minutes, and it's supposed to be a full-length episode, and I'm sitting here like, crap, I didn't, oh no.
Like, well then, never mind.
Yeah, if you find any accidental bonus episodes, that's why. Oof. All right. Well, are you ready to get into part two of the Cleveland abductions?
I am so not ready. Let's go.
Well, what do you remember from last week?
Well, I remembered a dog was murdered.
Yeah.
That's what scarred me the most. No.
I don't think it's more than that.
No. It all scarred me. It's very, right. Very bad.
This kid's rough.
No. What was her name again? Oh my goodness.
Michelle.
Okay. Yes. She went with Emily's dad because she trusted him. And then he ended up locking her up and abusing and raping her for about 2 years, is that what you said?
It ends up being 10 years.
Okay, yeah, it ends up being 10, but where we were talking, it was like past the 2 point, right?
Yeah, it was about
where
that.
Did I get two from?
Yeah. I don't know, that's a good question.
Okay, but yes, there's a quick rundown.
Yes, good, okay. So, actually, no, it wasn't even at a full year where we stopped. I just really wanted to take an episode to talk about, like, her childhood and stuff. Because, oh, that poor woman.
Yeah, that is very sad.
It was. Or it is, I guess. She's still alive. It is really sad. So, where we're starting today is April 21st, 2003. Which was one day before Amanda Berry's 17th birthday. So Amanda Berry is going to be the next victim that he kidnaps. So okay. Amanda Berry worked at a Burger King. This is also still in Cleveland, by the way. She worked at a Burger King, and this was the day before her birthday. So she was really, like, debating on if she wanted to go in or not because, you know, obviously. And she did end up going in for that day. So her manager there was her sister's husband, and his name was Teddy Serrano, and her sister's name is Beth Serrano. So that morning, Teddy and Beth had gotten into, like...
Is this spelled like a Serrano pepper?
It's spelled S-E-R-R-A-N-O.
So yes! Ooh, Serranos. All right, go on.
So that morning, Teddy and Beth had gotten into, like, a really big fight, and so the whole day that Amanda was there at work, she just kept, like, glaring at him, like, while she was there. Teddy and Beth lived with Amanda and her mother, and they lived downstairs at that house with their two daughters, who were named Mariah and Marissa, and they were aged 4 and 3. So that's our age. Those two little girls are our age.
Oh, no.
Oh, nothing happens with them. That was just a general, like, thought of it.
Oh, okay. I was like, I swear something spooky happens to them.
No, no. No,
it doesn't. Goodness.
What?
I forgot to mention this because we didn't really do like a how has your week been type of thing.
Okay. And we're backtracking.
I'm so sorry, guys, but we almost got human trafficked.
What?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Okay, it's a very quick story, but I want to tell y'all real quick just because, like, I mean, you know, it's scary. Okay.
And this has to do with this case in general. Like, this is a general, like,
yeah, safe. Exactly. Like, people literally will grab you and take advantage of you. Anyways, so I'm not going to say where, obviously, for, you know, reasons, but it was at a tennis court. And there was a gate leading into like not a safer area, but okay, so it was my friend's apartment, but it was leading into like the gated apartment complex. So we were like, okay, like it's a safe area because it's a gated apartment, you know? So we go into the tennis courts and we played for like a couple hours. And then at one point we all heard something different. One of my friends heard a cat meowing, which, you know, is sad because we're like, oh, it's in danger. And then I heard a girl screaming, hey, hey, like that.
Huh.
And then our other friend heard like a little kid screaming. So
those are three very different things.
Yeah. We didn't know what it was. Moral of that story was we didn't really know what we heard, right. But we just heard these noises. So one of my friends, she was like, "Ooh, it's a cat in danger." So she starts going out of the tennis gate, but not the gate that's connected to the apartment. It's like the gate that like exits everything, you know?
Yeah.
So she starts opening it. And then my other friend like comes up behind her and like slams it shut. She's like, "Do not open it. Like, don't." And so because of like the gate rattling and stuff, the noise stopped. And we were like, if that was a cat in danger, it would have still been meowing because if it's hurt, it's going to be hurt and would keep meowing, you know? And then one of my other friends pointed out the fact that like a tactic to lure people in is to use like voice recordings of like someone needing help. So that way you go help them and then you just get caught instead. So we were walking through the other gate that's connected to the apartment complex. And one of my friends calls her sister and was like, "Hey, can you just stay on the phone with us? Cause we don't know what's happening." We were very spooked at this point. Cause it was like midnight too.
Oh God. Yeah.
And so, we're walking through these gates and we see a guy running where we heard the noises from. We see a guy like leaving the premises, like he ran away.
Oh,
and
my God.
We jumped in my vehicle and then like skirted away. It was so scary.
You didn't try to hit him with your car?
Oh God. Well, no, because where we were at was, I wish we were on the opposite. It was like a kind of like a field because there was like tennis courts and then there was like some grass. And then we like ran across that to get to the car. And then we got into it, locked the car and then left. But yeah, anyways, that happened. It was very scary. And
holy crap. No, that's terrifying. I'm glad that you guys are okay.
Oh, me too. But yeah, I just want to throw that in there. So everyone be safe, especially like, I mean, I don't want to say especially if you're a woman, but I mean, if you're a man, you need to be safe too. But this was just me and three of my girlfriends. And I mean, I don't know. Right. It's tough being a woman, you know, like you have to think of the extra step. Like, anyways, we can resume this story, but I just remembered that and I was like, oh my God. So
another thing to be careful of is if you're in your house and you hear a baby crying, I've heard this one a lot. Yes. You have to call the police. Do not go outside or like
look for the baby. Just call them and then they can check out it. Because if it is actually a baby, which most likely it's not, then the police can take care of it.
Well,
then
I guess
the police can take care of it. And then if it's not, then the police can still like find the person that's playing the recording. But you stay in your house, stay close with your friends if you are out with them. You know, anyways, it was
always
very scary.
Have a buddy system.
Yeah, literally. Like after we heard that, like We told one of our friends, like, don't open the gate. And then after that, we were, like, all holding hands, like, you know, getting to the car. Like, we were really close together just in case we did get jumped. Then we could all, like, fight at once, you know? Like,
yeah,
you just got to try your hardest. But, yeah, it's a very scary world, guys. So.
Oh, it totally is.
Ugh. Yeah. Anyways, we can resume the story. Sorry about that little detour. I just forgot about it. And I kind of wanted to tell it on the podcast because we need to be self-aware and aware about, you know, like shit like this happens. So you need to be not saying like live in fear. I'm just saying like be, you know, aware.
Caution, I guess.
Yeah, there we go. Live in caution. Like, you know, think before you do something. But yeah, anyways, sorry. Now back to the show.
Okay. Well, we had a commercial break like 2 minutes into the show.
Hey, it's better than in like the middle, just randomly like, oh, hey, guys, by the way.
Right. Okay, so she ended up going into work and she was working, you know, with her sister's husband. Yeah. So at about 7:15, one of her bosses, who was named Roy, so not her sister's husband, asked if she wanted to head home early just because it was the day before her birthday. So she was like, yes, absolutely. And she ended up grabbing all of her things and called her boyfriend DJ to see if he would pick her up, but he didn't answer. So she just ended up walking home from the Burger King. And as she was walking, she had gotten a call from her sister Beth, and she was asking like if she wanted a ride, and she was like, no, it's okay. I'm already walking, like, don't worry about it. So while they're talking on the phone, she sees an old maroon van blocking the sidewalk, like up in front.
Ew, a van.
I know. So she sees an old maroon van like blocking the sidewalk, like an intersection in front of her. So she just like walks around it and doesn't pay much attention to it. And she looked in and she felt like she like recognized the girl in the passenger seat. And so she was like, okay, that's probably just someone that I used to work with at some point. And the driver was smiling and waving at her. So a couple minutes later, you know, she's still walking home. The van pulls up to her and asks if she wants a ride home. And she could, well, now she could clearly see who it was. And she definitely, like, recognized this man. I'm sure you could know who this is by now. So she was like, oh, yeah, I recognize you, definitely. And she was like, well, that's very nice of you to offer. So, yeah, I'll go ahead and get a ride.
No, ma'am.
And so she hung up the phone with her sister and she got into the van. And so she began to talk to him a little bit. And he said that his son used to work at Burger King and asked if she knew Anthony Castro. And she said that she does know him and that she also went to middle school with his daughter, Angie. And so she was like, oh, so how is Angie doing? And he said, oh, she's good. She's at my house right now. Did you want to go and see her? And she was like, okay, yeah, I haven't seen her in a really long time. So whenever he got there, he noticed that, you know, she was holding a phone. And he was like, oh, that's a really nice phone. Can I see that for a minute? And so she handed him the phone, like, you know, obviously not thinking much of it. And so he was just like looking at the phone. And then he got out of the car and he was like, okay, let me just go take the dog back so that you can get out of the car. Because remember, he does have a pit bull. So he took the dog somewhere. That's what it said. I wish I could tell you where he took the dog.
I know. I'm like, where is somewhere?
I'm sure it was just like the backyard, but I was just trying to figure it out and was like, where'd he take this poor dog? So he took the dog somewhere and then they walked into the house together. Once they got inside, he said, she's taking a bath right now. So let me show you around the house. And she said, oh, okay, that's really nice of you. So he showed her like a bunch of like general things, you know, like just around the house. And then he brought her upstairs. So he pointed to one of the closed doors upstairs and said, my roommate is in here. She's just sleeping. And she just like found this a little bit weird. And she noticed that there wasn't a doorknob on the door. And so she like looked down into it, like without him noticing, obviously, and saw a girl sleeping in there with a TV on. He then led her into another bedroom and closed the door. And whenever she turned around and tried to leave, he blocked the door and said, "Pull down your pants." So obviously she began to panic and she told him to take her home. He then did the same thing that he did with Michelle, which was he masturbated on her. I don't know if you remember that from the first part. And after that, he was like, "Okay, I'm going to take you home now." And this whole time, you know, she was yelling for help because, well, this traumatic thing was happening. Of course, she was yelling for help. And at this point, it seemed pretty obvious that he wasn't going to take her home. And so she was like, "Why is his roommate not helping me?" I can't imagine how confused she must have been about that. I mean,
yeah, no, that's very confusing. Like,
yeah, and I mean, knowing that it's Michelle, it makes sense. But
yeah, but in the moment, she doesn't know anything. So
right. So sorry, I was trying to find where it was. I had lost my spot. Okay, so he put duct tape over her mouth. It said in there that it was from ear to ear. And he taped her wrists together and her ankles together. And then he took his belt off and he tied his belt around the ankles. And then he got a motorcycle helmet out of the closet and put that over her head. And do you know why he said that he did this?
I'm sure it's some sick reason, but go on.
Oh, he said that he did this just so that he could take her back. Like, go put her in the car like that. What? Excuse me? No. All right. Yeah. So he took her downstairs and he tied her up to the same pole that Michelle was tied to. About a day later, she woke up to, like, really heavy footsteps coming downstairs, and he had brought her breakfast. Guess where he had brought her breakfast from?
McDonald's?
Burger King. You know, where she worked.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that seems like some sort of, like, psychological, like, mind game right there, because she probably got them from, like, her brother-in-law who worked there, you know? Yeah. Okay. So, anyway, sorry. so he brought her breakfast, obviously very kind, very sweet of him. And then he was like, "Okay, but first we're going to shower." And so he took her upstairs and he forced her to have a shower with him. And the way that she was describing this in the book that she co-wrote with Gina De Jesus, like, she was saying, like, he was showering her like she was a baby and was, like, rubbing all of, like, the stuff from the duct tape off of her face and, like, shampooing her hair and just icky stuff. Like, really gross. And throughout the rest of this, if you were to take a shower, he would take a shower with you, like, for all three of them. That's just the way that he did that.
That is absolutely disgusting.
Yeah. So after this, he took her to the living room and he gave her a breakfast sandwich, which was apparently a cold ham and egg croissant. I don't have that written in my notes. That just kind of stuck with me, you know?
A cold ham. Okay.
He took her to the living room where he gave her the breakfast sandwich, and then he took her upstairs and he just, like, it was in one of the bedrooms, and he just laid her down and laid next to her and he just fell asleep beside her. After this, he took her back downstairs again and chained her back up to the pole that she was chained on before. She was given a TV. She was given a small black and white TV, which I believe was the same one that Michelle had. So I think that she had gotten a new TV. But later on, it does switch because we'll learn that Amanda was his favorite. I mean, favorite in a sick way, obviously. But yeah. So she was given a TV, and so she was able to see her mother and Beth on Channel 5. And so she would watch this, and it was really disgusting. He seemed to just be, like, smiling over, like, what he had done. Like, he was smug about it. So at one point, he did, like, give her a journal so that she could, like, write whatever she wanted to write in there. But he said that she couldn't write any names in there. So, like, he did give her that rule. And let me just read you what she had written in there. So this was on the 27th of April. This is 1 week. I never thought I would miss my mom so much, but it's so true. You never know what you got till it's gone. I just can't wait to go home. I'm 17 now, but don't have a life. He told me I'm young and will go home before summer. Another 2 months. Tomorrow will be a week. I've been here. So I've survived this long. I'll just try not to think about it, but it's hard. I saw my mom and Beth crying on TV. My mom said, "Mandy, I love you," and I started bawling. I love you, Mom. See you soon. Love, Amanda. So, yeah, that's one of the things that she had written in her journal.
So sad.
Yeah. So, this guy is disgusting and sick, okay? I mean, obviously, we've covered that at this point. We're fully aware. But he told her that he used her cell phone to call her mother to tell her that they were in love and that she was his wife now. And that... Yeah. And that, yeah, she wasn't going to come back for a little bit. And that's why she was gone. Like, I'm sorry, what? Yeah. So, So, because he had such, like, a fondness for her, like I had said earlier, he would literally, like, treat her like his wife, you know?
Yeah.
So, this is a quote that was on there. So, this is April 29th. And she said this. He's back and he says he wants me to stay with me all night long. He keeps calling me his temporary wife. I move over to the very edge of the bed as far as away from him as I can get, but he cuddles up behind me and reaches around and takes my hand. It's like he thinks we're a couple. I lie still until he falls asleep, then I slip my hand out of his. He has ruined my life and my body. I'm filthy, my toilet is a trash can, I'm cold and hungry and chained up, and he wants to hold my hand. So that's her being captive for a week and a day. That's where we are right now. So he had promised, like, both Amanda and Michelle at this point that they would be, like, let out at different times. If you remember from part one, he had said, like, letting her out, Michelle out, I'm sorry, around, like, Christmas. So, or in, I believe, July, I don't know. He said, like, a time that was really far away. So, one day Michelle was watching the TV and she noticed that Amanda Berry kept showing up on there. And she could just, like, sense that he had kidnapped her and that she was there as well. So She asked him, she was like, did you take Amanda Berry? And he was like, no, no, I didn't do that. And then he introduced them one day. And apparently they had taken the same art class at some point, even though Michelle was at that point 22 years old and Amanda was 17. But recall from the first episode how Michelle like had to go back to school after a year.
Wait, so going back to school after all of that?
Oh, no, no, like whenever she had lived under the overpass.
Okay, okay, yeah, 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 okay.
Yeah, sorry. No, no, from that.
Yes.
So she had recognized her from an art class where they had gone to school together. And Ariel had told her that he had a new girl that he had brought into the house. And so she was like, okay, I used to go to school with her. I'm not stupid. I know what you did to her. And she was like, no, it's not Amanda. And so whenever they like were introduced, he introduced her as his brother's girlfriend.
Ew.
Very ew.
Ew, 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 ew. Okay.
Ugh. All right. So we're going to talk about Michelle for a minute because, well, it's been a little bit since we've spoken about Michelle. She got what seemed like the worst treatment out of like all of the three of them, which is really sad. So this part has a very big trigger warning for anyone listening. One time he found out that she was pregnant and he forced her to miscarry by starving her and bludgeoning her in the stomach with barbells.
What?
Yeah. And yeah, he learned that by one time he saw that she had milk coming out of her nipples, and he proceeded to call her a slut as well. And then after he forced her to miscarry, he came back in and abused her, saying, you aborted my baby. Those are the words he said to her. So,
I don't like this.
No, no, me neither. So Amanda would write in her journal for like most of the days. And at this point, she decided to do like a little code for how many times he would rape her in a day. So what she would do is she would put like an X and then like a 3 or an X and a 4 on there. Yeah. So I'm going to skip ahead like a little bit just because this is a part that I just would like to talk to in this part. So this is from November 17th of 2004. Let me just read this to you. There she is. My mom's on TV sitting right there with Montel and Sylvia. And they show Beth sitting in the audience. They must have flown to New York for the show. This is so exciting. So, Sylvia was a psychic that was on TV. And so they went there and they were going to try to learn what happened to Amanda from that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's like one of those things. So, Sylvia is asking mom about a Cuban-looking guy who is short and stocky. It's him. He's Puerto Rican, not Cuban, but it's close. Can you tell me if they'll ever find her? Mom asks. Is she out there? Then Sylvia says, I hate this when they're in water. I just hate this. She's not alive, honey. She said that to her mother.
My gosh.
Grieving, like not.
You don't like, say that to someone.
No, you don't. And that makes me really mad. Mom's, let me just keep reading. Mom's face just drops. I started crying and shouting at the TV. I'm not dead. I'm alive and I'm right here. Now Sylvia is describing how the Cuban guy wears his pants really low. Why is she talking about this? I can't believe this. My mom sounds desperate. So you don't think I'll ever get to see her again? Yeah, Sylvia tells her, in heaven on the other side.
Oh my God. Why be so negative about, I mean, heaven isn't negative, yeah, but like that's implying that she's dead and
yeah,
that's not what you want to think about.
No, it must be much better to, I mean, it wouldn't be good to be, I don't think that that should be a thing. There are some psychics that I fully believe, and that's your business. If you believe psychics, that's all you. That's none of my business. That's none of anyone else's business but your own. But to say that on live television to a mother who's trying to find out if her daughter's alive, there's
who literally just wants her daughter back, and you're like, no, she's gone. Mm-hmm. Like, and then you're gonna believe it because, oh my God,
yeah.
Anyways.
So after this, her mom started feeling like much more sad, you know? And so on the news, she was looking a lot more different. And apparently she took down like the yellow ribbons that she had outside of the house and she left them in Amanda's room. And then here is another quote from the book. He brought me the plane dealer because there's a story about me. And it says, my mom took down the posters in my room and gave away my computer. She says she's not buying me a Christmas gift this year because she's not sure anymore that I'm alive. All because of Sylvia Brown, that fake. She put a knife right in my mom's heart because it made for good TV ratings. The article says my mom is 98% sure Sylvia told her is what is true. That I'm dead. And she said that she lost it after the show. Whew. So, yeah, there's that.
That is so tough to read or listen to, I guess, but.
Oh, yeah. No, it definitely is. So, oh, now we're going to go back to talking about how Ariel was an absolute, what's the word? Oh, yeah, shitbag. How he was an absolute shitbag. So this is something that literally brought the police to the house. But they, remember how I told you how they would ring the leave?
This cut out. What was it?
Oh, I'm sorry. How it said, like, I told you the police would go to his door and ring the doorbell, but, you know, he wasn't there, so they just left.
Yes.
This is one of those instances. So if you recall, Ariel Castro is a bus driver, an elementary bus driver.
Horrible.
Uh-huh. So one day he was dropping kids off at school, but he kept one kid on. I believe he was a four-year-old. And so he one kid on. And he just went, he said, like, sit down or something like that. He, like, yeah, sorry. He was basically telling him, just sit down and stay back there. And he took the bus to Wendy's, okay? He took the bus to Wendy's. And then he got out and he went and ate lunch and told the kid, to keep still. I think he said, keep still, bitch. And then he just came back out and then took that kid back to school.
To this little four-year-old boy?
Yeah.
Sit still, bitch? What?
Yeah. Yeah.
Dad!
Like, I'm sorry, what? Pardon you? Yeah. So that's one of the instances that happened. And so, you know, the four-year-old kid went home and was like, hey, so this happened, and the parents were like, that's not good, you know? And so they did end up, like, calling the police on it, and he just got, like, suspended, so.
Are you kidding me? He literally he kidnapped this kid for like an hour to go eat.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, but don't worry. It was just, yeah. Okay, so now we are going to talk about the final victim who was captured by him. So her name is Gina De Jesus, and she was only 14 years old when she was captured. So a child.
Absolute 14 child. Is so young. That's literally so young. Your second year into the teen years. Like,
yeah. What? She was in the seventh grade.
Oh.
Yeah. And so she had seven people that she lived with. Seven people lived at her house. And that included her parents, her brother, her sister, and her sister's two daughters. And it seemed like they were like a very close family. So all of this happened on April 2nd, 2004. She was leaving her school for the weekend, and she ran into her friend, Arlene Castro, who was in the same grade as her. And they talked about hanging out later that evening. So, you know, they walked to a payphone so that Gina could ask her mom if Arlene could come over. So that Arlene could ask her mom if she could come over. But her mom did say no. And so they hugged and then they left. So she walked about a block down whenever a guy in a Jeep rolled up to her and rolled down the passenger window. She recognized the person inside as Arlene's dad. And she knew that he drove a school bus. And he asked her if she had seen Arlene, and she said, yeah, and then pointed in that general direction. And he said, well, can you help me find her? And she seemed very stubborn about having her help him find her. Sorry, that was a hard sentence to say. And so she was like, okay, sure. So she got into the Jeep, and he immediately started driving the wrong way. And so she was like, aren't you supposed to turn like right up here? And he was like, okay, no, I just need to go to my house to get money first. And she was like, okay, that's a little bit weird, but calm down, you know, it's your friend's dad. And also your parents know him. Like, her parents knew this man. They were friends. And so once they got there, he got out of the car, went inside, and then he came back out and he was like, hey, actually, I needed help moving a speaker from inside the house to in the car. And like, can you help me? And she was like, okay, sure. Yeah. So they got out of the car and he took her inside and just like kind of set her in the living room, I guess. And like, okay, get comfortable. And then he went into the bathroom. He said that after a little bit, like, she could see in the bathroom and he was like tweezing like his eyebrows and like trying to make himself look nice. Yeah, like, I'm
sorry, but you're not gonna look nice no matter what, so just stop.
Yeah, you're gross. And so she was getting uncomfortable because, yes. And so she was very loudly saying, okay, you have to take me home now. My mom is waiting for me. And then he walked up to her. He walked up really close to her and tried to touch her breast, like right there. And so she began to freak out and she was like, I need to leave. You need to take me home. And he said, okay, but you can't go the same way that you came. And so he took her down to the basement. And this is whenever she realized what was going on. And he did the same thing that he did with both Amanda and Michelle, where he tied her up and masturbated on her.
Ew.
Mm-hmm. He left her tied up there and left just the same way that he did with the other girls as well. Well, a few days pass, he did bring her food, and one day he brought her, like, homemade food that his mother had made. And he was like, no, look, I swear it's good. And he took a bite of it, and she was like, no. And so he said, okay, I don't care if you starve, and then took the food away. A little bit later, she was thinking about, like, all of the times where he used to, like, wave at her from the bus. And she asked, like, were you following me all of those times? And he said, yeah, you turned me on. I liked your cleavage. He said that.
To a 14-year-old?
Yes, to a 14-year-old. And he said, I liked when you wear the black V-neck shirt and the jean skirt. It was my favorite. Excuse me? Yeah. So there was obviously, you know, a search going on for Gina. However, they were looking at the wrong person. So let me just tell you about one specific lead that they had, that the FBI had, okay? Sorry, I had to readjust. So
I heard the distance in your readjusting.
I just have to get comfy, you know? So one person that they, the main suspect was Arlene Castro's stepfather. Yeah. Even though it was her actual father that did it. I'm heated. Okay. Basically, when the two girls had said their goodbyes at the phone booth on the day that Gina had disappeared, Arlene crossed the street and walked directly to Westtown Square, where, I forgot his name. Where do I have his name written? Fernando Colon. I'm sorry. Okay, where her, Fernando was working as a security guard, and he gave her a ride to their house on West 106th Street, which was 100 miles away. So the FBI had figured that he would need no more than 5 minutes to drop her off, and then, you know, he could just go back and get Gina. And so this obviously raised red flags for the FBI because he knew Gina, he carried a gun, and he had opportunity. So, 5 days after she was missing, the police picked up Colon for questioning. The FBI was actually familiar with him because he was given an award for helping them solve a bank robbery. So, while he was being questioned, the agents, like, searched his car and they used luminol to look for traces of blood, but nothing was found. And so, he also agreed to a lie detector test, which he did pass. So this next part is going to be quote-unquote from the book. Colon and the FBI have starkly different memories of one aspect of his interrogation that day. Colon insists he told the agents that they were talking to the wrong man and then that they should turn their attention to Arlene's biological father, Ariel Castro. He claims he informed them that Castro not only knew Gina, but was a violent man who had been abusive to Arlene's mother, Grimilda Figueroa. So they, the FBI, however, just insists that he never mentioned Castro at all. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Right?
This is so much.
It really is. So a little bit later, he decided to introduce her to Michelle. So he introduced her to Michelle as his daughter, Emily, who she was friends with. And so obviously she was like,
She's gonna be like, no, that's not, okay.
Yeah, this is not Emily.
Idiot.
I mean, Michelle and Gina just went along with it because they were like, yeah, I'm not gonna mess with this guy, but it was very obvious. So here's another, like, psychological torture thing that he would do with them is he would make them play Russian roulette.
How is that played again?
Okay, so you put one gun, or I'm sorry, one bullet into the pistol, and then you spin the barrel, and then you just shoot yourself in the head to see if you get killed or not. Because you don't know where the bullet is.
I thought it was with an arrow.
No, it's with a bullet.
What am I thinking of then when you like shoot an arrow in the air, but you have to like stay still?
I really don't know. I don't want to do that though. That sounds like a terrible.
Well, that's what I was talking about. Okay. Anyways.
No. But what he would do is he would shoot them in the head. And then he had said, okay, so I'll give you the chance to shoot me in the head. But if you do it and it happens, that just means you don't trust me. But Gina was like, yeah, I'm going to do this because I'm not going to let it like not happen. So she did it and he didn't get killed. But he was just so excited about all of this happening that he was like, okay, cool. And he didn't even care that he didn't get killed that way. So, yeah, this man's just crazy. So sick. Yeah, absolutely sick. So at this point, you know, Gina's 14, Michelle's 22, 23, and Amanda's 17, 18. Yeah. So around August 2004, he moved Michelle and Gina into the same room. So Gina just basically got moved into the same room that Michelle was in. And he was saying, okay, well, the mattress is just big enough to share, so you two are just going to be there. And he would still rape them almost every day. And I had read somewhere that they would hold hands while he was raping them to, like, comfort each other.
Seriously, so sad.
I know. It's so sad. At this point as well, he started to try to pit, like, Amanda against Michelle and Gina. So Amanda had nicer things. Amanda had like the nicer TV and stuff. Obviously, she's still a victim here. That's not what I'm saying. I hope I'm coming across like that.
Oh yeah, no, I get it.
And so like he was making her seem stuck up to them that way they wouldn't like her. Or no, he was telling Amanda that they thought that she was stuck up. And he was making her seem stuck up to them. That way they just wouldn't like each other. So he was literally just starting like drama just to keep torturing them. Yeah. So at about this point, he realized that, you know, Amanda was his favorite. He called her his wife, all of that. So this is terrible. So whenever he would rape Michelle or Gina, this is after just like a bit, he would take them outside and rape them. So it wouldn't be in the same house as his marriage to his wife.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So on August 23rd, he went upstairs and he was basically like, okay, you guys need to start packing all of your stuff. You are going down to the basement. And the reason that they were going down to the basement was because, his kids had been asking questions and they were like, yeah, so why can't we see our childhood bedrooms anymore? Like they were just asking questions about that. And so he had to move them all to the basement and make it like look okay up there. And so they ended up living downstairs for a little bit. And that's whenever like the three of them started talking more. And they realized that he was playing mind games against them to try to get them to hate each other. So on August 27th, 2005, they had been in the basement for 4 days at this point, while his kids had just been like coming to and fro, like visiting them. And then at this point, he took them all out into the garage and piled them up in that one van. And he only put Amanda's mattress on there. And remember, Amanda had the smaller mattress. And he gave them some old soda bottles just filled with water. And then there was, you know, there was no air conditioning. So he plugged in a very small fan into like the side of the garage and he ran it into the car. And he also plugged in Amanda's TV into the car. So they were like that for 3 days. 3 days.
Oh my God, that is horrible.
And during one of these times, he actually did come in and rape Amanda while they were in all of these close proximities.
That is seriously so depressing. Oh my God.
So something that they just kept thinking about was, like, one of his daughters is staying here and she's like 50 feet away, but she doesn't know all of this is happening. So she can't do anything about it, you know? Yeah. So on August 30th, he brought them back inside. So we're going to skip ahead a bit to March 2nd of the next year. And Amanda was watching the news and she learned that her mother had passed away from a heart attack.
Oh my God, that is so sad. So her mom didn't even get to see that she was still alive? Oh no. I hate this.
Yeah.
I hope you know I don't enjoy this story.
No, I don't enjoy it either. But we have to tell it. It's important for people to know about. Yeah.
It is important, but, you know.
Yeah. No, it sucks. It sucks really bad. And at one point, Ariel had, like, promised her that, like, she would get to go to one of her parents' funerals if it happened, but he just fully backed out on that, you know. Fully backed out on it. Since there was a ton of information over Amanda Berry in the media, and her mom was such an advocate for getting her back, they did like show the funeral on TV, so she did get to like watch it, which was good. So she did get to see that. And on April 22nd of that year, Amanda was writing in her journal, and she wrote, "Also, I think I'm pregnant."
Oh, no.
So she told him in May. But the reason that she had waited so long was, well, you know how he treats Michelle.
Yeah.
She was worried that he was going to do the same thing to her. But, you know, no, this is his wife. This is great. His wife is pregnant. So, on December 25th of 2006, Amanda gave birth to a baby girl named Jocelyn. So basically she woke up on December 25th and she just wasn't feeling well at all. And she felt a pop and there was like a little bit of blood. And he said, like, "Your water just broke." And she was like, "Oh, crap." So she had to give birth in the basement. Like,
oh my gosh. With
no, like, medicine, nothing like that. And he did, he went and he woke up Michelle because, you know, Michelle has a kid. She has Joey. And so he told her, like, "You have to help her with this." And, like, just wasn't a part of it at all, like, of helping. So, I'm sorry. My cat just stuck his paw under the door trying to open it. He doesn't need to be in here. He doesn't need to be in here. His food, his litter box, and his water is all out there. He just likes the blanket that's in here.
Well, you better throw the blanket out there to him. Come on now.
No, we need to do it. We have to finish this. I want to be done with talking about this guy.
Me too. Let's wrap it up.
Okay. Well, we still have quite a bit to go. All right. So Michelle was like forced to help her have the baby, which, first of all, at this point, he had probably forced about 5 miscarriages for her. And now he's making her help her give birth to another child.
That is seriously so sad.
Yeah. So Jocelyn was born not breathing. And so he started like screaming at Michelle and he was like, make sure this baby is alive. Like, make sure she's breathing or I will like fucking kill you. That's what he said. And so she was like panicking, obviously. And so she was like giving the baby like CPR and Jocelyn was okay. Like she's okay. And since, you know, he didn't want to buy any baby clothes because he didn't want to raise any suspicion, he made outfits out of, like, old socks.
Ew.
Yeah, it was gross. So as Jocelyn got older, you could tell, like, how much that he did really love her. Like, he would videotape her doing things. He would call her pretty. Like, that was his nickname for her. And whenever she was a toddler, he would, like, take her out, like, into town and stuff and be like, oh, this is just my girlfriend's daughter. So something that happened was he did introduce Jocelyn to, like, one of his kids. And they were like, that looks just like Arlene as a baby. Like, are you sure that's not your baby? No, this is just my girlfriend's kid. It's not mine. Yeah. So he made both Michelle and Gina come up with other names because, like, if she was going to talk about them in public, and if she were to say like Gina or Michelle, like that would raise suspicion, you know? So they came up with some nicknames for her to call them. And so Michelle went by Juju, and she went by this because Jujubes were her favorite candy. They were Jocelyn's favorite candy. And Gina
that went is by so the cute. Name.
Oh my gosh, it's so cute. And Gina went by Chelsea. And the way that both of them describe Jocelyn is so sweet. They were talking about how she was just like a little like a ray of light, like in their life. And it, yeah, like she was just great to have around and they were so happy that she was there. So like she would hang out with them all the time, like with both Michelle and Gina, like she would just go hang out with them and go play with them and everything like that. And she really loved them, but you know, they were chained up. So he made it very clear that they need to make sure that there was, like their her chains weren't visible to them at all. Otherwise, you know, she would be, like, worried. Like, she wouldn't know what's going on, and she would think that that kind of thing is normal and may tell that to people, like, outside, you know?
Right.
So he made them cover up their chains and just, like, make sure, like, so that they wouldn't think anything is wrong with it. So, though we haven't talked about this a lot, Ariel Castro was a raging racist. Like,
yeah. Oh my god.
Yeah. He actually would never let Amanda Zeno made his way in, and now he's right by the microphone. he actually would, like, not let Amanda listen to rap music because, like, that's the kind of music that Black people make, and that's not okay.
Ew. The heck? Uh-huh.
And he would just say like a bunch of racial slurs to them. And the day that Michael Jackson died, he said this: one last in on the planet. Yeah. Yeah. So this guy is really wonderful, a great guy, honestly. So, in June 2009, he actually took the chains off of Amanda to make it easier for her to take care of Jocelyn. Because at one point, like, the thing that she had over her handcuffs, or, like, her chain, it it fell down, so it didn't look like a bracelet anymore. It looked like she was chained to it, you know? So Jocelyn was like, what's that? And so he took it off of her. And this is the first time that she hadn't been chained in like 6.5 years. Can you imagine?
I seriously can't even fathom this.
Yeah. It's a lot. This case is a lot. And aren't you glad I'm only doing 2 parts instead of 3?
I am very glad.
Yeah. I mean, you can tell how much I have here. It could have easily been parts. We're condensing it. We can get through this. So, in 2010, Gina started going through a major depressive episode, and she began to cut herself. And one of the quotes in the book was, "I have almost no control over anything, but nobody can stop me from cutting myself." And, well, you know, both Amanda and, Michelle, I almost said Jocelyn, both Amanda and Michelle were really trying to, like, help her out to not do that anymore. So here's a really, really weird part. This was June 18th, 2010. And I'm just going to read this word for word. This is from Amanda's point of view in the book. He's taking a bath when he says he wants to tell me something. "Is it bad?" I ask. "Yeah," he says, "and you have to promise not to hold it against me." This can't be good. He's never said anything like that before. What could he possibly tell me that I would hold against him after what I would hold against him more than kidnapping me for 7 years? "Okay, I promise. What is it?" "It's my daughter, Emily," he says. "She sliced her baby's neck and tried to kill herself." "Is the baby alive?" I ask. "How could Emily have done that?" "Yeah," he answers. "She's okay. It happened a while ago, but now Emily is going to prison for 25 years. He told me before that Emily's had a lot of problems with depression and mental illness, but I can't believe she would do anything like this. "I'm sorry," I say. "I can't think of anything else." "Maybe this is God's way of punishing me for doing this to you guys," he says. He thinks everything is about him. So that happened in 2010 as well.
Wow, that was literally only 10 years ago.
Yeah, no, it was. So she still has 25 years in prison, huh?
Wow.
Yeah. All right, we're very close to the end, by the way. So, yeah, for these last few years, I'm sure you can tell, I'm, like, jumping around a lot. I felt like the more important stuff to establish was what happened to them in the beginning, you know?
Yeah,
so right. So you know, like, the terrible things that they have endured. It also, in their books, it seems to jump from whenever Jocelyn was born to whenever she was a toddler. So it seems like very similar in that way in both Michelle's book and Gina and Amanda's book as well. So on August 24th, 2011, Amanda, well, you know, Jocelyn was 5 at the time. She decided to do a little like first day of school for Jocelyn where she set up a tiny classroom in their bedroom. And they acted like they were in school for the whole day. Like, she packed her a little lunch and everything.
Oh my god, that is so cute.
Oh my gosh, it is so cute. And she, like, taught her the whole day and gave her recess and stuff. And they acted like she dropped her off at the bus stop to go to class and then picked her up afterwards. And oh my gosh, I'm, like, tearing up thinking about it. And they did that every day until summer was supposed to begin. Every day. She just wanted her to have, like, a normal life. Oh my gosh. Okay, so we're jumping
ahead. Excuse me while I cry.
Yeah. So we're going to go ahead and jump ahead another year. So on August 30th in 2012, Gina and Michelle had learned that there were bed bugs on their mattress. And, you know, the thing that he did to help them was he got like a big sheet of like tarp, like plastic, and he tied it on there with duct tape and said, well, that will kill them.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So now we're going to jump ahead to the day that you've been waiting for, which is May 6th, 2013.
Yeah.
So I bet you're excited for this, huh?
Yes.
I am too. My goodness. Okay. So. This is written from Amanda's point of view. Jocelyn was shouting, "Daddy's gone, Daddy's gone," as she was running up and down the stairs, and she couldn't find him anywhere, and she was just confused. Our bedroom door is unlocked. Whenever he leaves the house, he's always careful to lock us in, so he must be somewhere downstairs. But I can't help her look for him, because going down on my own would be breaking one of his most serious rules, and I don't want my chains back. "Go check the backyard," I tell Joss. "He's probably out there. It's a warm day, so he must be outside messing around with, like, cars or motorcycles." Joss heads back down the stairs and is wearing a long black wig because she loves to play dress up, and she takes a peek out the back door window, which is locked from the outside, and she heard her little footsteps race down to the ground floor looking in every room. And then she came back up, and she said, "Daddy's blue car is gone. And so at this point, you know, Amanda's like, oh my gosh, like he is actually gone. And he had never left her without not locking her bedroom.
Right. So they see this as an opportunity.
Oh, definitely. And Gina and Michelle were in the other room and they're listening to all of this. And so they were like, okay, this could be like a trap. And so they were just, they just didn't do anything. Because what he would do is he would test them to like make sure that they wouldn't run. And so they were worried.
And then be waiting there for them.
Yeah. So they were worried that this would be that kind of thing, unfortunately. So they got like really excited, but they were like, okay, maybe we should just stay back. So Amanda like went down the hall. And so she's like, definitely like looking around, trying to be careful for trying like, and getting back up there. So, she was really worried about what would happen. He found her because apparently once he had taken away electricity for her not speaking to him. Yeah. So she leaves Jocelyn in the room, and so she tries to go down the stairs, and the radio isn't on either. And remember, he would always leave salsa music blasting loudly outside. And so she was like, okay, no, he's gone. Like, I need to go now. And so she ran up to her room, and she put shoes on, and then she ran back, like, out. And apparently, this is from Gina's perspective, there was a little knock on the door that sounded like Jocelyn knocking to let them know what she was doing. And Amanda was like, no, leave them alone. Like, well, we need to, like, do this first. Because, Amanda didn't want them to be part of it, too, if it wasn't true. She was, you know, looking out for them.
Right.
So she went to the front door, and it was unlocked. Like, the front door was fully unlocked. So there was, like, the door was unlocked, but there was, like, another door in front of it, you know? So there was a storm door. That's what it's called. So there was a storm door there that was chained shut with a padlock, so they weren't able to get out that way. So they were like, okay, crap, like I need to get somebody's attention.
I would have busted it open.
Oh yeah, no, she's going to, don't worry. So she was like trying to get it out, and so she starts to scream. She's like, help me, I need to get out of here. And a guy who is a great guy, we'll talk about him in a minute. I talked about him a little bit in episode one, but we'll talk about him in a second. He sees them and he like comes up to the porch and she's screaming like, "Can you help me?" And so he's trying like really hard to help. And okay, this made me really mad. I'm going to read this quote for quote. "An old lady comes by on the sidewalk, sees what's happening, waves her finger at us and says, 'No, no, no.'" What? This older lady sees her struggling to get out of this situation and she's like, "No, no, no." What?
Like, what?
Excuse me? And so she was yelling, "Please, I'm Amanda Berry. Like, please help me." And another guy came up. Actually, this is the guy I was telling you about. Goodness gracious. And so he looked at the door and he was like, "Oh man, this thing is locked." And he was like, "Okay, yeah, please just help me." And so he looked at the bottom of the door and like, he started to like kick out the bottom panel and he was like, "Okay, kick it out. Like just finish kicking it out." And so she, you know, finishes kicking it out. And so she like squeezes out and then she pulls out Jocelyn with her. And so then he calls the police off of that. And I just want to find you the way that he worded this 911 call. Do you remember how I told you that this was like the inspiration for Kimmy Schmidt?
Yes.
Okay. I need to find the transcript of this. Here it is. Okay. "Cleveland 911, police, ambulance, or fire. Hey, yeah, bro. I'm at 2207 Seymour, West 25th. Hey, check this out. I just came from McDonald's, right? I'm on my porch eating my little food, right? And this broad is trying to break out of the fucking house next door to me. So it's a bunch of people on the street right now and shit. So we like, 'What's wrong? What's the problem?' She like, 'This motherfucker done kidnapped me and my daughter and we've been in this bitch.'" "She said her name is Linda Berry or some shit. I don't know who the fuck that is. I just moved over here. You know what I mean." And then the dispatcher goes, sir, "You have to calm down and slow down. Is she still in the street?" "Uh-huh. Seymour Avenue." And "Is she still in the street?" And he was like, "Yeah, I'm looking at her. She's like there right now and I'm calling you and she's on the other phone." "Is she white, black, or Hispanic?" "She's white, but the baby look Hispanic." "Okay, what is she wearing?" And he like just describes all of that. And one of my favorite parts is he says, "Are the people she said that did this, or are they still like in the house?" And he said, "I don't have a clue. I'm just standing out here with McDonald's." And the dispatcher said, "Can you see if she needs an ambulance?" And he said, "She needs an ambulance or what? She needs everything. She's in a panic. I bet she was kidnapped. So put yourself in her shoes." So yeah, that was the 911 call that like ended up saving them.
I love the 911 call. It's kind of funny.
Honestly, it really was. So after this, you know, the police came in and they were trying to like get her. You can find that online, by the way. You can find that and you can find the interviews that he gave afterwards. And so whenever the responding police officers got to his house, they went upstairs with like their guns drawn and they like announced themselves as the Cleveland police. And they you know, the girls were still going to be hesitant because he had probably done this before where he had said it was the police to see how they would react. But as soon as they saw their officers, they like, she like, Michelle ran and jumped into one of the officers' arms and was saying, "You saved me," to her. And she like was not able to be put down.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So all three of the women were taken to Metro Health Medical Center. where Amanda and Gina were released from the hospital the next day, and Michelle wasn't discharged until 4 days later, which was on May 10th. And apparently the rescue of this ignited some hope for the family of Ashley Summers, who disappeared from Cleveland in July 2007. But she still hasn't been found yet, unfortunately.
Oh my goodness.
So, just so you know, Ariel Castro was arrested at a McDonald's. I feel like I need to throw that in there. He was arrested at a McDonald's. Yeah.
So, wow. Mm-hmm. What a great ending for him.
I know, right? So, he was arrested literally at a McDonald's, and his two brothers that he was with, they were also taken into custody, but they were released on May 9th after, like, they realized that they had nothing to do with it.
Right. No correlation. Got it.
Like, at all.
Wow.
So, so he was taken to jail, and he made his first court appearance on May 9th, where the bail was set at $2 million per the kidnapping charge, $2 million per kidnapping charge, which added to a total of $8 million. Like, his bail was $8 million. And additional charges were aggravated murder, which was for the miscarriages, attempted murder, assault, a charge for each instance of rape, and a kidnapping charge for each day each captive was held.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
Good.
Right? Good.
So, I like that he was charged for each instance of rape. Uh-huh. Not just like, oh, he raped her.
Yeah.
But like, yeah. Constantly.
Right. So he entered a not guilty plea. Of course he did. Right. So on July 12th, the Cuyahoga, I don't know how to pronounce that, the grand jury there returned the bill of indictment from the remainder of the period from February 2007. Which brought to a total of 977 counts. So it was 512 counts of kidnapping, 446 of rape, 7 of gross sexual imposition, 6 of felonious assault, 3 of child endangerment, 2 of aggravated murder, and 1 of the possession of criminal tools. So, you can imagine how many years. Oh, go ahead and take a guess, actually.
Oh, God, I don't even know. lifetime in prison?
Yeah, so he got life in prison plus 1,000 years.
What?
Yeah, like, they were like, ah, dude, you're not getting out of here.
They're like, even after you die, we're just going to keep your corpse there so your spirit's stuck in prison for a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Good.
I do have one more thing to make you mad, though. I'm very sorry.
Why?
So, he committed suicide on September 3rd of 2013.
Kidding me?
It was less than a month into his sentence, and he hanged himself.
So he literally didn't even get, like...
No, he didn't get shit compared to them.
That was easy way out, bitch.
I am cursing a lot in this episode. I'm just, like,
mad. Me too. It's okay. Wow.
And so, yeah, no, he committed suicide, but there is also a report that suggests he may have died from accidental autoerotic asphyxiation, which I guess is something that could happen because he's gross, but...
What is that, though?
Whenever you choke yourself during, like, he was choking himself during, while masturbating.
Oh, wow.
Because he was found, I think, with his pants down.
He's disgusting.
Ugh. Oh, very disgusting. But yeah. That is the Cleveland kidnappings. And all of these women are thriving now. They're doing great. All of them are working, like, towards this not happening ever again. like they all, well, both of them have books. I was telling you about two of them. So Michelle Knight has the book Finding Me, A Decade of Darkness and A Life Reclaimed. Both Amanda Berry and Gina De Jesus, they have a book together, which is called Hope, A Memoir of Survival in Cleveland. They had, like, offered Michelle to do the book with them, but Michelle wanted to write her own thing because she did have a lot of things in the beginning as well. I can send you some pictures from Michelle's book to post on the Instagram.
Yes, please.
It includes what it looked like in the basement and, like, in the bedrooms and stuff. So I will send you some of that. It's terrible and disgusting. And Michelle Knight does also have another book, which is called Life After Darkness, Finding Healing and Happiness After the Cleveland Kidnappings. I haven't read that one, but I really want to read that one.
That one will be interesting.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Wow. There we have it, guys.
There it is. So, do you feel the need for a palate cleanser, or do you feel good knowing that he's rotting in hell?
Honestly, I'm good knowing that he's just rotting in hell.
Yeah, no, me too, definitely.
Because even though, like, yeah, he killed himself, so he didn't really get his full sentence, but, like, good riddance.
Yeah, he doesn't deserve to be on the planet. I would much rather him be rotting, being tortured there, but, you know.
Yeah.
I'll get what I can get. So, exactly. Yeah.
Anyways, guys, this was a long episode, so we'll go ahead and wrap it up for y'all. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Yes. We'll let y'all know when we are posting another one soon. Follow us on Instagram at
Horror Slumber Party Podcast.
Twitter.
Party_horror.
And we also have a Patreon.
Horror Slumber Party Podcast.
And also email us at
horrorslumberparty@gmail.com.
So you can give us your ghost stories. It is spooky season, so we gotta put some more ghost stories out there for y'all. If you want to be a special guest, just let us know, and we love having guests, so we'll
also
call you up or something.
If you're a Spotify music thing, please don't email us and ask to do things together.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah, we're a podcast.
Yeah, I got an email that said, from one independent artist to another. And then it was like, I'd really love to work with you. It was like, I came across your email on Spotify. And I was like, yeah, so we're a podcast. Thanks.
Yeah, that's
right. Yeah, definitely not doing any beats. Thanks, though.
But yeah, stay tuned to our posts. And y'all, thank you so much for listening. Good night and scary dreams.
Bye.